It was first year university. We were both taking women's studies in Ms. Horsefall's tutorial, or Horseface as we imaginatively renamed her, even though she was more hawkish than equine in appearance. Her serious, makeup-free face suggested to us that she was gay. That's what everyone said back then about women like her. What she needs is a good root, we'd say laughing, and gifted by some red-blooded hetero man, naturally. We also wore no makeup and had hairy underarms, but we were supple-skinned and flirtatious. That made us immune from the kinds of taunts we slung at Horsefall. As eager as I was to find my new uni tribe, Alice didn't hit my radar straight away. Perhaps it was her purring Canadian accent that initially deterred me. I'd recently moved down to Melbourne from Sydney with my parents, so while scouting about for a suitable scene, I dismissed those from overseas or the country. I pictured two-minute noodle dinners in share houses filled with other out-of-towners, piling into university buses to comedy nights with $3 jugs of beer. I thought they'd all behave like drunk, horny backpackers, and I'm afraid Canada meant little more to me than Celine Dion and Mountaineers. But then in week three, the infamous separatist feminist Harriet De Silva was a guest speaker in our women's studies lecture. De Silva, nudging 6 foot tall, spiky grey hair, steel blue eyes, marched into the hall, leered at us like a rearing cobra, then spat out the notion of a matriarchal society where men were kept like animals, farmed for their semen and then killed at adolescence. "Men start the wars," she declared. "They're responsible for the violence. There isn't a single crime that women commit more often than men." The room was dead quiet. Then, from up front, Alice's hand shot to the ceiling. "How about infanticide?" she called out. She looked sweet as pie with her long blonde plaits, sitting tall in the middle of the front row with her hand still in the air. De Silva spun around to locate the voice. Her eyes narrowed. Alice continued, "Infanticide is the single crime that women commit more often than men." The two of them argued for a solid 5 minutes before De Silva, standing centre stage, cut Alice off and announced with a smirk to the rest of us, "No one has come here today for a criminology lecture." Alice sat back in her seat, arms crossed, quietly triumphant for the remainder of the lecture. I looked towards her several times, wanting to signal my approval, but never managed to catch her eye. At the end of the lecture, I gathered my books and ran to catch up with her at the top of the stairs. "Great what you said to De Silva," I said. She shrugged as she looked at me. "She might be a celebrity around here, but she's still got to stick to the facts." "Sure," I said, catching a closer look at some of the badges crowding her denim jacket. "Racism sucks," "nuclear-free zone," a colourful mandala, and one with heavily scrawled pink lettering bejewelled with sparkles and flowers, which I only just managed to decipher as the word cunt. Back home, you're encouraged to debate ideas. You're not just supposed to just sit there dumb, sucking it all up like people do here. I nodded, unsure what to say, whether I was being implicated in her critique. We stepped outside. To my right, I saw two policemen walking up the alleyway in our direction. "I didn't think the pigs were allowed on campus," I said, appealing to her clearly rebellious nature. "They're not," she said with a frown, removing her jacket. We stopped and watched as the two men strode past. "Oh, thank God!" Alice called out, loud enough for them to hear. "The police are here. I feel so safe now." She was grinning, her eyes alight as she waited for a reaction. "I gotta go," she turned back to me, still smiling. She'd clearly enjoyed herself. "Got a job interview at the radio station." When she jogged towards the large, yellow brick union building, I noticed that the floral cotton top she was wearing was backless, just a front piece held on with a few ties across her back. And below her long, Rajasthani skirt and silver anklets, she wasn't wearing any shoes. "I am on a lonely road and I am travelling, 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 travelling. I'm Sonia Orchard, and Into the Fire is my third book. My first book, Something More Wonderful, was a memoir, and that's also about female friendship. A couple of years later, I wrote my first novel, The Virtuoso, which won the Indie Award for Best Debut Novel in 2009. I then had three kids, which slowed my writing down. So Into the Fire, another novel, is the first book I've published in 10 years. Into the Fire is the story of two women, Lara and Alice, who meet in a women's studies class in 1990. They're both idealistic, energetic feminists who are ready to take on the world. But they both end up making very different life decisions, and that really affects their friendship. The first hump in the road is when Alice meets a charismatic, somewhat volatile musician called Crow, moves to the country and has kids, and her mental health starts deteriorating from there. Meanwhile, Lara travels the world, focuses on her career, and only starts to think about kids in her 30s. The story of their friendship is actually told by Lara in her mid-30s, heavily pregnant, a year after Alice's death in a house fire that it's believed Alice lit while in a drug-addled state. Lara feels very guilty about Alice's death, and so she's gone down to stay with Crow, Alice's widower and their kids, and that's where she starts unpacking her relationship with Alice. And that's when she starts to realise that the stories she's told herself about her life, about her friendship, about Alice and Crow, aren't necessarily the entire truth. So it starts off as a relatively light story of female friendship. By the end, it's extremely dark, and we actually realise that Lara is complicit to a degree in Alice's very tragic death.
Into the Fire is a beautifully written and deceptive page-turner. It's also difficult to read at times. For large tracts, it saunters. Not meandering or purposeless, but with an understated self-confidence. The way Sonia embeds politics into the bodies of Lara and Alice is highly political. I started by asking if she set out to write a political novel.
I actually didn't realise how political I was going to get in this story. When you start writing, it's a little bit like undergoing therapy. So I didn't realise how much stuff was going to come up for me about the role of gender. There was a lot of stuff that I had buried, like in the Me Too movement, women started talking about things that they'd never talked about. The moment they started allowing themselves to have a voice, nothing was going to quieten them down. That kind of happened to me with writing this book.
While I was reading, I was thinking that Into the Fire was almost like a detective novel, but without the usual stereotypes, tropes and dodgy gender roles. In that sense, did you intend to write a detective-esque novel?
In a way, yes. The process for writing, for me, it's a process of digging and of discovery. In the early stages of writing this novel, I had my third child and my dad died soon after, and I spent a lot of time thinking about my past. When my dad died, I talked a lot with my siblings, and I think this is quite common amongst siblings after a parent death. We had completely different takes on our childhood. It was as if we were remembering very different families. It was quite astounding. And that got me thinking about the role of narrative in a person's life, how it's created as a kind of survival strategy. You tell yourself the story that best services your life. After my dad died, I ended up back at my counsellor's trying to work out what had happened during some teenage years where I had some quite dark experiences which I hadn't ever really addressed. I was looking for answers, talking to friends from back then, asking them what they remembered. That's what Lara's doing. She's trying to extract the truth. By the end of the novel, I think she's pretty much there, and that's when it becomes quite clear why she's lived in this massive state of denial for so long.
And just on that, in the case of you finding out certain things about your past, did any of those end up in the novel?
There are sort of thematic crossovers and things like that, but I couldn't say that it's autobiographical at all. I kind of threaded themes and wove them in. That's probably the closest I could say.
While I was reading again, I was trying to put this all together, and I was just wondering if your characters are broken.
They are kind of broken, but probably as broken or flawed as your average high-functioning middle-class person. They're the kind of people who, if you met, you'd probably think they've got it together. Underneath, clearly, they're all quite messy, but that's quite normal, I think. What makes them seem the most flawed to me is that they're full of contradictions, and I find contradictions in people really interesting. Health nuts who smoke a lot of dope, the romantic who can't commit. In the excerpt I read earlier, we've got Alice and Lara in first-year uni feeling very enlightened and empowered with their very progressive feminist ideas, but at the same time, Lara makes very homophobic and misogynistic comments about her teacher. And as we start to see soon after in the story, she quite plainly puts the needs of men first. So when you see contradictions in people like that, like with Lara, I think you get a good glimpse into their fears, their vulnerabilities. Lara is, for me, essentially a good person, but she does some very bad things. And readers have contacted me after reading the book asking, how will Lara ever forgive herself? My intention was to explore why decent people do bad things, why they betray themselves and others. It's something I find very fascinating. Sometimes there isn't an exact truth to be found.
Did you consciously sort of set the novel in a particular time and place in Melbourne in the early to mid-90s?
I first did it because I based it on my own era. It was easiest to write it in that way, using my own memories of uni life and pop culture. The 80s and the 90s were really interesting times for feminism. I was born in 1970, so me and my cohort are the kids of second wave feminism. Our mothers fought for the freedoms that we got to enjoy. And there was a lot of expectation on my generation of women, and I should preface that with saying privileged middle class women, that we could go out there into the world and do anything a man could do. And we were all told that, and we were all encouraged to put education and career first and to definitely do those things before kids. There was no mention of biological clocks and difficulties with of conceiving later on, we were all just told, get a career, don't worry about family for the time being. It wasn't considered okay to aspire to be a mother back then. You just never would have heard women talk like that. And yet nearly all of my female friends from back then are now mothers. So yes, I really wanted to explore the effect of this kind of cultural upbringing and the effect that it had on the women of my era. I think that most women I know would look back over their lives and say that their lives have turned out very differently to how they imagined from when they were teenagers.
This is 4ZZZ. We're speaking with author Sonia Orchard about her third novel, Into the Fire, her creative processes and the things in her life that influence her writing. Has becoming a mother changed your writing?
Definitely. I think, yeah, it's hard to really kind of put your finger on it, but I feel like I'm really sort of down and dirty amongst it. In humanity terms, you're confronted with your own childhood and you're then confronted with what you're bringing into the future. Also, it's just made my heart swell 3 times in size. There's more reason to write and to take risks and to be vulnerable. I'm less concerned with my public self. I'm primarily, especially at this stage in my life, my identity is very much as a mother. I've got 3 quite young children, so that's my primary role. And what the rest of the world thinks of me, I'm less concerned with that now. Whereas I think when I was younger, I was much more tied up in my public identity. These days, I want my kids to see me be authentic. And I haven't really thought about them reading my writing later on, but I think from, you know, how well they know me, they wouldn't be too surprised probably. But it's definitely a book that I hope young women do read and respond to, because there is so much of my reflections on the experience of that transition between being a teenage girl and being a young woman and then being a mother.
You do tell nuanced and complex stories of those issues of women, of pregnancy, of motherhood. Finally, I did ask you to choose some music today to go with this interview, and the songs you chose were Joni Mitchell's All I Want and Avalanche by Leonard Cohen. Could you just give us an insight into how music impacts on this novel and your writing process and the significance of these songs?
Music has always had a huge impact on my writing process. I was more a musician growing up than a writer. I studied music to quite a high level, and both my novels feature musicians. My years of musical training have really impacted my writing. I always read my work out loud and listen to the sound of it. I'll often add extra syllables or switch words around in order to service the beat and the rhythm of a sentence. But even before that stage, I find music really helpful. I remember during the writing process of this novel, I was driving to Preston Library in Melbourne, where I drove to every day to write, and I was nearing the end of the manuscript where it does get quite dark, and Avalanche by Leonard Cohen came on the radio. I just pulled over, closed my eyes and listened to it, and I remember saying to myself, that's what I want to capture. That's the feeling. That's what I want people to feel when they finish reading this book. Avalanche for me is so full of sadness, grief, nostalgia, beauty, and has this simmering, creeping darkness, almost a hint of violence in it, which for me is quite frightening. Regarding my first choice, Joni Mitchell, I chose that song because in my early 20s, I spent a few years backpacking overseas and I listened to that album a lot. And that song for me really captures that feeling of being a young woman on the road. The optimism, excitement, bravado, vulnerability, innocence. And my character, Alice, is Canadian, and I just imagine that she would have also listened to Joni Mitchell in the 90s, in her 20s. So that song's kind of for her.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with 4ZZZ today. The book is awesome and amazing, and as I just listened to you talking about it, it is all those things. It is lyrical. It's got a beautiful rhythm to it. It was one of those things, it's a page-turner, and then it's difficult to read at times as well. Thanks so much for letting us into your world a little bit as a writer.
Thank you very much. Lovely to chat.
That was Sonia Orchard, author of Into the Fire, ending that report. Into the Fire is published by Australian publisher Affirm Press and is available at bookshops and online at affirmpress.com.au. If anything in this interview has made you feel like you need to speak with someone at any time about anything, you can contact Lifeline. Operates a free confidential 24-hour support line, 13 11 14, and a nightly online crisis support chat, lifeline.org.au. Griefline operates a free confidential phone service from 12 p.m. to 3 a.m, 7 days, 1300 845 745, that's national landline only, and an online counselling service, griefline.org.au. And the Suicide Callback Service operates phone, video and online counselling 24/7. That's 1300 659 467 or suicidecallbackservice.org.au. You're listening to 4ZZZ. Here is Leonard Cohen's Avalanche.
Step into an avalanche. It covered up my soul. When I am not this hunchback that you see, I sleep beneath a golden hill. You who wish to conquer pain, you must learn to serve me well. Of love that you offer me, they're the crumbs I've left behind. Your pain is no credential here, it's just the shadow of my wound. I have begun to long for you, I who have no greed. I have begun to ask for you, I who have no need. You say you've gone away from me, but I can feel you when you breathe. Dress in those rags for me, I know you are not poor, and don't love me quite so fiercely now when you know that you are not sure. It is your turn, beloved, it is your flesh that I wear.